Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this critical midterm election day as polls are closing in the East and discuss the role of women, both in terms of the record number of women running for Congress and in state and local races, and what is expected to be a pivotal role educated suburban women who previously voted Republican are likely to play in flipping the House and possibly the Senate. Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute for Politics at Rutgers University, joins us to discuss how, for the first time in history, Americans could elect more than 100 women to the House and 23 women running for seats in the Senate. Depending on whether there are results to report along with projections from exit polls, we'll also look at key House races in New Jersey, where Navy veteran helicopter pilot Mikey Sherrill is poised to turn a red state blue, and in Virginia, where there are four closely watched races with Democratic challengers Abigail Spanberger, Leslie Coburn, Elaine Luria, and Jennifer Wexton running in red-leaning districts that could turn blue. But even if all 100 women were to win today, come January 2019, women would still only hold 24% of the seats in the House. Then we'll check in on another critical battleground for control of the House and Senate, Minnesota, where the Democrats could flip some seats, but where also the GOP has the best shot of picking up seats currently held by Democrats. Lawrence Jacobs, the chair of political science and director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert Humphrey School of Political Affairs at the University of Minnesota, joins us. With both U.S. Senate seats being contested, along with the governorship, we'll assess what impact the Kavanaugh hearing had on setting back the Democrats' chances of taking the Senate. Then finally, we will head further west and examine the House and Senate races in Texas and key House races in California, which offer the Democrats the best chance of going a long way to pick up the 23 seats nationwide they need to flip the House. Lydia Camarillo, the vice president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project based in San Antonio, Texas, joins us to discuss the extent of Latino turnout in South Texas, which is critical for Beto O'Rourke's chances in taking the Senate seat away from Ted Cruz, and some of the tight congressional races in California in districts with large Latino populations. And joining us now is Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University, an organization nationally recognized as the leading source of scholarly research and current data about women, American women's political participation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Debbie Walsh.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for getting all that in about our group.
Well, I must say that just in the intro, we've already got some news when I mentioned the four Democratic challengers in Virginia. Jennifer Wexton is now being declared the winner by CNN. So they picked up one of those four Virginia seats. It looks like at this point the Democrats may have picked up just on the East Coast, and not all of the East Coast, maybe 12 or even 14 previously held Republican House seats. And they're certainly looking good in Florida, both in terms of Andrew Gillum being ahead for governor and Bill Nelson being ahead for the U.S. Senate to hold onto his U.S. Senate seat. So what's your sense here of, I know we want to talk to the women, but
It's a little early for the women. We haven't, we've only had that one race called so far. Although there's another race with Spanberger in Virginia that also is looking promising at this moment. We're watching all of these races and reporting them in real time. And we're also watching what happens with the women's vote and the kind of impact that women voters may have on the outcome of all of the elections, not just the races with women running.
And in your state of New Jersey, the polls have just closed. I mentioned Mikey Sherrill in the opening. I think she's a pretty safe bet, don't you think, to win?
You know, you just never know. So we'll wait until we start to get some results there. But that's been a very interesting race to watch. Mikey Sherrill made the decision to get into that race very early on when Rodney Frelinghuysen, the current The current holder of that seat was still in it. He was chairs the Appropriations Committee, a very powerful position. And he had been elected for many years as a kind of a moderate Republican in a pretty moderate Republican kind of a district. And he, as with the election of Donald Trump, he started to swing more and more to the right, particularly to hold on to his leadership position. And it made him more and more vulnerable. And then he decided to pull out of that race and not run for reelection, which left that as an open seat. And a quite conservative state assemblyman has made the decision to run, Jay Weber. And it's been quite a battle. But it's a district that, while it had elected a Republican for many, many years to Congress, it supported Hillary Clinton in 2016, which was really the opening for the Democrats. And a bit of the story that we're seeing around the country, where the Democratic Party is targeting districts from red to blue. It's where did Hillary win in districts where Republicans are now sitting? And this was one of them. And Mikey Sherrill is the kind of candidate that I think the Democrats dream of, and it's a bit of a new version of women candidates. She is a Navy veteran, helicopter pilot. She was a federal prosecutor. She has young kids, and she's run a very strong campaign and really, I think, enjoys campaigning and is out there all the time with her family. And telling a different story than sort of what we've been used to seeing for women candidates. So we're watching that with great attention. New Jersey currently only has one woman member in its congressional delegation, a woman named Bonnie Watson Coleman, also a Democrat. And so it's been quite a while since we've had two women serving simultaneously in our congressional delegation. So that would be a big victory for women in the state.
Notwithstanding, you mentioned it's a conservative Montclair area of New Jersey. Nevertheless, the former governor of New Jersey referred to it as one of the callers from Montclair as the communist from
Montclair is actually a very liberal part of the district. It's a kind of a funny district. It spans, as do a lot of interestingly, gerrymander districts do meanders around the state, but it includes parts of the state that are much more conservative, much more Republican, Morris County, but it also includes parts of Essex County, which include Montclair, and Montclair is a community that is kind of the shorthand for it. It's when the Upper West Side of Manhattan decides that they need a little more yard space, they move to Montclair in New Jersey. So it's a pretty progressive area, and that's the part of the district that Mikey Sherrill is from.
And again, I'm speaking with Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute for Politics at Rutgers University, an organization nationally recognized as a leading source of scholarly research and current data about American women's political participation. So given that more than 100 women are running for the House and I think 23 women are running for the Senate, this is obviously a record, but as I pointed out, even if they all win in the House, it'll still only be 24% women as of January 2019.
Yeah, we've got about 235 women who are nominees for Congress, 183 Democrats and 52 Republicans, 22 women, 15 Democrats and 7 Republicans running for the Senate. When we look at the numbers and where they are, if every woman who is expected to win wins, and then if all the women who are in toss-up districts were to win, which is not likely, but just in case, we might get to about 25% women in the U.S. House. Now, right now, they're 19.3%, so that's a significant increase, but I think it's important to remember in a year that has been repeatedly labeled the year of the woman, if things go as they might, we still might see women's representation only at a quarter. And so there is still a long way to go, and while it's important to have years like this, we need more of them if we are going to see gender parity. And we also need to see more work being done on both sides of the aisle. The Democrats have done a better job of electing women to office. They're still not at 50%, but women make up about a third of the Democratic caucus in Congress right now. On the Republican side, women make up only about 10%. And if we're going to get to 50% women in Congress at any time, it's going to have to come on both sides of the aisle. So there's still going to be plenty of work to be done, even after what could be a very good year for women.
Well, of course, the day after President Trump's inauguration, there was a spontaneous demonstration of millions of women across the country and around the world. It was an extraordinary. Of course, Donald Trump was chafing about it because he's very insecure about the size of his crowd, and the women clearly outnumbered him in a manifold way. So that indicated to me that there's a movement out there, maybe inchoate, but maybe it's showing up today. The other aspect that I want to talk to you about is this sort of assumption amongst pundits that the swing vote in this election to swing former Republicans to vote Democrat is amongst college-educated suburban women. Is there any evidence that this is happening?
Well, we'll have to see what the results are from the exit poll, so we're a ways away from knowing the answer to that. But that's been the population that Donald Trump has been losing. And his disapproval ratings among women have just been climbing. And so, in particular, the group that is more likely to be a Republican voter, white, college-educated women, suburban women, we're seeing them shift away. I think there was a misconception that somehow all women would vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016, and we knew that wasn't the case, that women vote on issues and they vote by party, and I think Republican women voted Republican ticket in 2016. I think there are a lot of women out there who have become disillusioned by this president's rhetoric and some of the positions that he's taken on issues. I think the harshness with which he's approaching the immigration issue. I think the issue of health care, which is first and foremost on the minds of voters, women and men. And I think that is going to have an impact on how these women vote today. So that's one of the things we are going to be watching for tonight and in the coming days as the exit polling becomes clear, to see what happened with women voters. We know that black women are the strongest of Democratic voters. We know that women do vote differently than men, and women overall are more likely to support Democratic candidates than men are, and less likely to support Republican candidates than men are. But there is variation among women. So as I said, black women are some of the strongest Democratic voters and consistent Democratic voters out there. Single women and white college-educated women came out and did support Hillary Clinton. She got about 51% of that vote. So that vote moves around. It is white women without a college degree that are the most Republican of voters, and I'm not sure if they've shifted or not.
And are they more Republican than white men without a college degree?
No, but there's still a difference among those women, but of women voters, they're probably the most solidly Republican women voters.
So just a couple of new results that we can report. Of course, Bernie Sanders is reelected. It looks like Senator Warren is reelected in Massachusetts. Senator Sherrod Brown is holding his seat in the Senate in Ohio. Doesn't look good for...
Looks like they called the race for Tim Kaine in Virginia, too.
Right, Tim Kaine, Virginia. But the Indiana seat of Joe Donnelly is not looking good. The Democrats have picked up another House seat that was in Republican hands. That's Donna Shalala in Miami. Kemp is beating Abrams very badly so far.
Well, I think it's still, at least before I got on the phone, we were at 4% of the vote in Georgia. So I wouldn't get ahead of ourselves on that. I think we have to really watch to see where is that 4% of the vote coming from. I don't think it includes DeKalb County and the Atlanta, greater Atlanta area. And
right.
I think that's where we're going to start to see what's going on with that. So I think it's a little early yet to make any kind of prediction. I think that's going to be a very, very close race. I think it has potential to have to go into a runoff into December. So that is a complicated race.
Yeah, they're still at 4%, so that is not significant. And conversely, of course, Beto O'Rourke is significantly ahead in Texas, but that's 14% so far. So this is clearly too early to call. But in general, though, it's always been pretty clear, hasn't it, been that the sort of Democrats are the Women's Party and the Republicans are the Men's Party in a very loose sense. I think something like 60%+ of women tend to vote Democrat and 60% of men tend to vote Republican. That's a fairly consistent trend, is it not?
We know since 1980 we've seen a difference in the way women and men vote. And also in their turnout levels. So we know that women are outvote men. About 10 million more women voted in the 2016 presidential election than did men. And we also know, as I said, that since 1980 they vote differently, and that difference can make in a close race can make a real difference in the outcome of the election. So, for instance, in 2016, Donald Trump got 41% of the women's vote. Hillary Clinton got 54% of that vote. Trump got 52% of the men, and Hillary Clinton got 41% of the men. That was an 11-point gender gap in that race, with women 11 points less likely to support Donald Trump than men did. So this is something that we have been seeing consistently since 1980. It makes that women's vote a vote that has been really fought over. In the past, the Republican Party has worked very hard to try to make some inroads into that vote. You certainly saw that when George Bush was running. George W. Bush, in fact, one of his little slogans was that the W in George W. Bush stood for women. And I think when John McCain selected Sarah Palin, that was an attempt to somehow get to women voters. I think that it is clear, Mitt Romney did a lot to try to make some inroads into that women's vote. I think it's pretty clear that Donald Trump has made very little effort to make inroads for that and to try to close that gap up. I think that he, in fact, has exacerbated that, and as much as he's saying that he won't take credit for what happens and the outcome of this race on the House side, if the Democrats take the House, the reality is he's tied himself to this election. He said, if you vote for so-and-so, the Republican candidate, it's a vote for me. And so this has become a referendum on him, and I think we will see what happens with those women voters.
And just in closing, the race for both governor and Senate in Florida is now very, very tight, and it's hard to tell who will win in either of those races. And I thank you very much for joining us here this evening, Debbie Walsh. And again, I've been speaking with Debbie Walsh, who's director of the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute for Politics at Rutgers University, an organization nationally recognized as the leading source of scholarly research and current data about American women's political participation. We're going to take a brief station break and back checking into another critical battleground state for control of the House and Senate, Minnesota. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair for Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include Politicians Don't Pander, Political Manipulation and the Loss of Democratic Responsiveness, Who Governs Presidents, Public Opinion and Manipulation. And his latest book is Fed Power, How Finance Wins. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be back with you.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. And Minnesota has a couple of critical House seats going on where the Democrats could flip the second and the third districts, but I also understand that there are also opportunities in the 8th district and the Iron Range region for the GOP. So at this point, have the polls closed?
Shortly.
Shortly.
Closing shortly.
And at half past the hour, right?
It's actually 8 o'clock Minnesota time, which would be 6 o'clock your time.
Oh, okay. Well, that's when the program ends. So then we're being highly speculative. But you do have both senators up, right, for the substitute senator for the outgoing Senator Al Franken, and you've got Amy Klobuchar as well, and both the governors as well, right?
Yeah, it's a very big political year here in Minnesota. And I can already tell you that we are expecting huge turnout. It might actually be a record in the modern era. The turnout in 2014 was 1.9 million, and the numbers that we're looking at now could well be 2.6 or 2.7 million, which would be a 35% increase. It's really quite extraordinary.
Well, since we can't, well, there's not much point in speculating, although I wanted to ask you about when I look at the sort of interviews with people lining up to vote around the country in particular, a lot of focus, of course, is on President Trump's racist rhetoric in the last closing days with the extremely racist commercial that played on the Super Bowl. And there's this feeling that educated suburban women on previously voted Republican are offended by Trump. But there's also evidence on the other side that a lot of women and men in particular were offended by the Kavanaugh hearings, and they feel that the Democrats behaved rather poorly. So does that kind of balance it out? What's your sense of the kind of moral quotient, if you will, in this election? It would seem clear to me that President Trump is simply not a moral leader by any stretch of the imagination. But morality has always played a large part in American politics. You know, the politics of abortion being an example. So, what's the moral thermometer here, to your mind?
Well, you know, I think there's two thermometers. Which is fitting of a country that's so, you know, divided. There are very enthusiastic Donald Trump supporters here in Minnesota and around the country. They see him as restoring kind of the strength of the United States. They see him as, you know, really standing up for them and what they believe in. Donald Trump has had extraordinary campaign rallies in Minnesota. And I think we're going to see pretty strong turnout among Republicans in Minnesota and elsewhere in the country. So I think that's the difficulty, which is Donald Trump is, you know, presenting this ethnic nationalist view that's quite offensive to a lot of people and certainly crosses the line in terms of racial sensitivity. But there are a lot of Americans who are supportive of that, and I think tonight it's going to be a battle of who turns out to vote.
And what about the commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness? I mean, I think there have been many, many compilations of Donald Trump's blizzard of lies into the thousands. And in the last closing weeks and days of this election, they've been coming thick and fast. Does that bother people, or if it doesn't, why not?
You know, I think it bothers those who already disapprove of Donald Trump. I think his supporters, partly because they're looped into Fox TV and online sources, believe that's what's happening. I was talking to a Republican friend, and he was telling me about Democratic mobs. And I looked at him and I was like, what are you talking about? There's a few isolated instances of rude behavior, but there's not Democratic mobs. But, you know, he'd seen this on Fox TV and heard the president talk about it. And he took it at faith, you know, that's what was going on. And clearly people are being misled and manipulated. So I'm not sure, you know, that the Republicans in the country are really doing anything but rewarding Donald Trump tonight. And I think Republicans will do quite well in some parts of the country. They're really mobilized and see the country at risk of being taken over by these threatening forces.
Well, that idea of the Democratic mob came out of the Kavanaugh hearings, as far as I recall, that the idea was that this was sort of a lynch mob. I wonder whether, you know, that really did blow the Democrats' chances of taking the Senate. Your senator, of course, Amy Klobuchar, she came across, I think, pretty well. But in general, it wasn't a profile in courage for Democrats. Some of them were auditioning for a presidential run later.
Yeah, and I think some of that has been overplayed. The reality is that three-quarters of the senators who are up for election this year are Democrats, and 10 of those, about a little more than a little less than half, are running in states that Donald Trump won, and 5 are in states that Donald Trump won overwhelmingly. So the playing field is about as bad as I've ever seen it. So I think always it was the case that Republicans were favored. The question was, how many seats would they pick up? And I think tonight, if they pick up 2 or 3, that's far short of the 10 that some were talking about even 2 or 3 months ago.
Well, one factor which doesn't get a lot of attention is simply the kind of screwed up nature of our democracy, where the last two Republican senators won the White House with fewer votes than their opponents got. And in the case of those who voted against Kavanaugh, those senators that voted against Kavanaugh received 38 million more votes than the senators who voted for him. So there's some real structural issues here. I don't know how they can be addressed. There's a recent study that indicated that by the year 2040, the red states will be electing 70 U.S. senators and the blue states only 30.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so important to have this mobilization of Democrats in red states. We're seeing that in Texas. We're seeing it even in places like Idaho, where you would not expect it. And in some cases, this is going, you know, beyond the Democratic Party. We're seeing people at a very grassroots level just speaking up and kind of self-organizing. And there'll be plenty of issues to organize around. I don't think Donald Trump is going to end his presidency on a high note. I think there's a lot of consequences from his economic policy, including the trade war that's been a disaster for farmers, the tax cuts, which are putting us into a really perilous fiscal position.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter Eppenjohn Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include Who Governs, Presidents, Public Opinion, and Manipulation. And his latest book is Fed Power, How Finance Wins. So when you talk about, you mentioned your friend who talked about these wild Democratic mobs, that all comes from Fox News. And so are the Democrats running as much against Rupert Murdoch as they are against Donald Trump?
Well, I do think there is an extraordinary cabal involving the president and Fox News. We saw it just last night or the night before, where Hannity and another Fox News news person showed up at Donald Trump's rally and was kind of applauded. We haven't seen that in America. That's really pretty extraordinary. It goes back to the 19th century when there was very explicit partisan media, but we have not seen that in, you know, probably a century.
Well, he also had the Fox, the former, the I guess he succeeded Roger Ailes after he was run out of Fox for sexual harassment and some pretty appalling behavior. And then Bill Shine, his successor, is now the White House communications director. So it feels like there's a kind of loop there, you know, between Fox, the White House communications director, and the president himself. And he goes on Fox all the time on that show where they sit, these people sit around in chairs and essentially spout propaganda. One of whom, the woman in the middle, I can't remember her name, the other day, said, "Why can't journalists in this country just print and report what the president says?" I mean, that's straight out of Pravda, you know.
In fairness, there's you know, there is alternative media, including on cable channels. There's alternative radio, such as your program. I think the Washington Post and the New York Times have, you know, kind of found their legs after being really kind of asleep at the wheel for a while. They're now hard-hitting reporters digging up stories, and if the Democrats go on and capture the majority in the House, there's going to be some fairly extraordinary news as the House uses the subpoena power to begin to dig in what could be extraordinary corruption. And we could talk about several of those cases. The one that I'm personally most interested in is whether there's a kind of a pay-to-play with regards to these exemptions from the tariffs. It's gotten no attention at all, but I don't think it's random which companies are getting a pass on whether the tariffs apply to them.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get into the names of these companies. I mean, I've just casually looked through the names, and there's, you know, dozens of companies who've been spared tariffs. And it obviously has a tremendous impact. And just kind of watching this administration, it's hard for me to believe that's just random.
Right. Well, the other issue, of course, is the special prosecutor. You know, all of the intelligence and law enforcement people that I talk to, they say this Trump's record is beyond belief, you know, that they make a case that this man is both a criminal and a traitor. And one wonders whether that is why Trump has been in such a sort of panic mode in the last week to try and stop this Democratic takeover of the House, if indeed it appears to be the case tonight that will happen. Either way, I think there's a good chance, don't you think, Lawrence Jacobs, that shortly, maybe even as early tomorrow, the Attorney General is going to get fired. Trump, if he wins the Senate and the House, then he can basically get rid of Mueller altogether. But if he loses, he might want to do a damage control and shut it down. And as far as I know, there's no obligation in the way that Mueller probe is structured for that probe ever to be made public, and Trump could always classify it as top secret.
Well, I think there's other alternatives, including the fact that Mueller can't pass the bar of collusion between Donald Trump and Russians. Instead, you know, in a sense, says there's not enough evidence here with regard to the president. And for Donald Trump, that would be terrific news and a reason to keep Mueller on so that he can be, in a sense, you know, claimed to have been cleared, even though I think there'll be plenty of damaging information. And it could be the case that Donald Trump's son, Donald Jr., faces perjury charges.
And there are also some possible charges that could ensnare Kushner, his son-in-law, as well.
Yeah, but I think, you know, that what's going on with Mueller is very important, but there is going to be other investigations. There's plenty here in this administration that needs to be taken a look at, and even if Democrats can't pass legislation because it'll be blocked in the Senate or vetoed by the president, they can use that subpoena power, if they're smart, to begin to build up a record of corruption that is not something we've seen in some time.
But in the broader sense, though, Lawrence Jacobs, I find it astounding that just trying to keep up with Donald Trump on a daily basis, I find astounding how incompetent, how flawed he is in terms of his own personality, his rampant egotism, his ignorance. It's a frightening spectacle on a daily basis, and you would think, and other people around the world appear to see it, yet a lot of people in this country don't see it. And in general, the point I want to make, though, is I don't understand why the Democrats can't make a stronger case, you know, that this is appalling what's happening to this country's leadership. I mean, this is – we've never seen anything like this. And you know, you just said that maybe the subpoena power will bring out some of this corruption, but it seems to be – all over the place in so many aspects of misgovernance.
Yeah, and I think there's certainly people in America who agree with you strongly. But there's also probably a third or 40% who disagree with you strongly. And one of the challenges has been to understand how that could be, even though you're looking at the same picture. And one of the most important developments is that politics has moved away from our debates over policy and really become a social identity. We are kind of melded to our political party, and it answers the most fundamental question, who are you? And what we're seeing is people living and working and even what they're buying seems to be very much tied up with the political party they're in. And so, yeah, they could well be looking at or would have available to them this kind of disturbing information that you've just described, and it doesn't move them because fundamentally they're kind of melded to the Republican Party. All they need to see is the R.
Well, it's true, but I don't believe that Trump seriously thought he was going to win, and he ran, I think, to improve his brand as a sort of marketing exercise. And we know that on the night of the election, his wife was in tears, and he didn't even have a speech prepared, a victory speech. And this is a man who's been one step ahead of the sheriff forever in a very sort of dodgy world of real estate. But if you really, if just from the people I've interviewed, from the books that I've read about Trump's record going back to the 80s with money laundering with the Russian mob and then the KGB and then throughout that whole era up to the present and trying to figure out what this peculiar hold that Putin has over him. I mean, I could recommend about 10 books that seem to make an incredibly strong case. And until this guy Mueller delivers something, which I don't think – you say he may not deliver anything of any substance, it seems extraordinary that we're in this sort of alternative universe where this fellow that was schooled by Roy Cohn may well pull it all off. And
So I think Mueller will deliver quite substantive findings, and I think it'll be quite extraordinary. You could think of what Mueller is doing as the first – thorough investigation of white-collar crime that we've had in America in some time. And it's pretty much every rock he's turning over, he's finding, you know, really massive corruption with, you know, what, 19 people already indicted, many of them on charges of bank fraud and that sort of thing. So I think there's plenty of substance with what Mueller is doing. The question is, will he be able to have enough irrefutable evidence of collaboration between Donald Trump and the Russians? And there, I think that's – I haven't seen any evidence of that to this point. Now, here's the big question, and I think I know where you stand on it, which is the best way to run against Donald Trump by putting up his flaws? This was a strategy Hillary Clinton ran on, it, and it didn't work that well. Or is a strategy to put up an alternative direction for America. Donald Trump has presented a view of America as closed, as a kind of ethnic nationalism with a tinge of racial animosity, whereas the alternative would be one that talks about the power of America's diversity, our openness to the global community. And I think that's really the debate that Democrats are looking to engage in, and then to bring in these positive, constructive policies that can make a positive, that can make a constructive difference in people's lives.
Well, that's what I mentioned earlier, Larry, is that, you know, there's an awful lot that you could run on without having to depend upon Mueller. And I'm I'm astounded that they haven't come up with a really coherent narrative. And, know, if the best narrative you have is we're not as bad as the other guy, we've heard that one before.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. And I think the question will be after tonight whether we're going to see a Democratic presidential candidate coming forward who can do that. I think it's very hard to do what you're talking about during a midterm election in which there are, you know, 535 races going on, or 470. It's just hard to do in that context. But beginning of the new year, we're going to be seeing presidential candidates emerging, and I think the kind of question you're asking should be answered.
Well, Lawrence Jenkins, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair for Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. And his latest book is Fed Power, How Finance Wins. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the Latino vote in Texas and California.
What's my name? What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, sure, take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for me.
Was it the first setting? That we learned, is it just a premonition? Could we really get ourselves to burn? I've been sent here on a mission to find what we agree upon. We don't agree about September, could we agree on the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lydia Camarillo, who serves as the Vice President of Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan organization based out of San Antonio, Texas. She plays a key role in developing the tactical strategies for the SVREP, nonpartisan voter registration, voter education, and get out the vote campaigns. President Clinton and Vice President Gore appointed Lydia to serve as the CEO of the 2000 Democratic National Convention, and prior to joining SVREP, Camarillo served as the National Director of the Leadership Development Program for the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lydia Camarillo.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Lydia, so far, it looks like there have been 21 GOP House seats that the Democrats are leading in at the moment. So they're only two short of the 23 they need. And of course, we haven't even got anywhere near California. What I find extraordinary is that how I know it's still not the vote's still not in. How well Beto O'Rourke is doing in Texas. What's your sense of whether that's going to hold, that substantial lead?
Well, a second ago, he was ahead. Beto O'Rourke was ahead. Now he's behind by about 30,000 votes.
I see. So
there's two things to remember in Texas. The polls just closed. It's 254 counties that have to turn in their information. We don't even have all the counties yet with the early vote. for the first time in Texas, we've seen presidential level turnout in a midterm. And the bottom line is nobody votes in Texas, so the outcome is going to be quite interesting. Second, the Latino electorate votes usually either part of the early vote towards the end of the cycle or towards the end of election day because people are working. So we're we'll know, and it's hard to say. But what's clear is that it's too early to tell still. But I think there's going to be at least two, maybe three, congressional seats that flip as a result of not only the Latino vote but the excitement that Beto has brought to Texas. There hasn't been a Democrat at the top of the ticket winning for more than 25 years. So with that, there's excitement that we haven't seen. And so I think this provides for more excitement for 2020.
Well, I guess we should be cautioned here because when the program started, it looked as if both the Democratic senator and the Democratic challenger for governor in Florida looked like they were ahead and doing well. But now the race is closed with 91% of the vote in, and Nelson is slightly behind in the Senate race and the governorship race. Also, the Democrat is slightly behind. So we shouldn't be basically. It's too early to for a coronation of Beto O'Rourke.
It's too early for not only to determine the Texas election, but Florida as well, because even though Florida closed a little earlier, and we've already we've seen already in Florida that the 27th flipped, and which is used to be held by a Republican, now Donna Shinella will hold it, will be serving there, and we're seeing some interesting outcomes in Florida. But it's still too early. There were people voting early, and so that has to be counted. So we'll see. I think the most important thing that we're seeing is that for the first time in a long time, we're seeing the kind of excitement that we have seen in a midterm election across the United States. In most cases, including in Texas and in Florida and in Arizona and Nevada, the turnout rates are at presidential levels. Perhaps not at presidential levels where it's a very competitive election, but certainly at presidential level, something we don't see very often in midterm elections.
Well, Barack Obama remarked after the 2014 midterms, which were pretty appalling, some of the lowest turnouts ever, that the Democrats have an almost genetic problem showing up in midterms. Now, that has clearly changed, but this big turnout, automatically you would have assumed, well, this is really good for the Democrats. This means that their people are really showing up. But it's not quite that simple, is it? It looks like a lot of Republicans are showing up too, right? So is it really a case that Donald Trump is really getting his people out?
Well, when you have in places like Texas where the turnout is so small compared to non-red states where there are investment and there are competitive seats, then you don't have a sense of what could happen when there's competition. So both groups are energized. Both groups spend a lot of money. While in Texas, O'Rourke spent money that was individual dollars from people. Cruz spent a lot of money with lots of different, I think he had something like 11 PACs in addition to his own resources. And he obviously felt, the Republicans felt that they were going to lose Texas. And so they gave it their all by bringing different PACs, spending resources to attack Beto O'Rourke. And also the president, to your question, I'm not sure that it's a question of supporting or opposing Trump as much as it is the Republicans, there's room for them to grow because just like Democrats in Texas aren't turning out at the levels that they should, neither are Republicans. And so the competition is very obvious this time. So we'll have to wait till the last vote is counted to get to see what's going on. I think it's going to go back and forth all night.
Right, but when you talk about money, and obviously since Citizens United, the Republicans have had the advantage, and we know that about 40% of the money pouring into these midterms is what they call dark money, which is not attributable. So that is a terrible future that we...
Right, but in the last 10 minutes that we've been talking, Beto was down. Beto is now up, 1.9
right. Well,
million to 1.8.
I was about to say that he's running on small donations, as a number of the younger and more progressive Democrats. So that's a harbinger for the future, don't you think, that it shows that in spite of how corrupt and money-driven our politics are and how much plutocrats have an advantage, you can still be competitive if you inspire your base.
Well, he's certainly showing Democrats and Republicans alike, but certainly Democrats, that you can have a message that's progressive. He stood against the wall, doesn't understand why the children are caged, believes in legalizing marijuana in a red state, believes in policy issues, including universal health care, that you don't see conversations about those kinds of policy discussions in Texas. So to your point, he's raised a lot of money from small dollars. He raised a lot of money from a lot of people in Texas and outside of Texas, but still small dollars. The average dollar, I believe, was $37. He's discussing politics in a way that we haven't seen before, including not being afraid to talk about the importance of the immigrant community and the contributions that they've made, and disappointed and outright speaking about why it's important that the immigrant community make a contribution, and also taking a stand on the men who kneeled fighting for the position of democracy and against police brutality against their communities. So he's done something that I haven't seen Democrats do. The other thing that I think he was able to do is energize thousands of volunteers that not only gave money, but block walked and phone banked in a way that I haven't seen, particularly in a red state. And I'm sure that that's the case in most states. In California, we haven't yet talked about California. The polls haven't closed yet. But I believe that the two-tier top of the ticket that end up in November, I think it has an implication on voter suppression. And I don't think we're going to see the kinds of numbers that we used to see when it was more competitive.
And again, I'm speaking with Lydia Camarillo, who serves as the Vice President of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan organization based out of San Antonio, Texas. And prior to joining SVREP, Camarillo served as the National Director of the Leadership Development Program for the Mexican American Legal Defense Education Fund. So even though we don't have the polls haven't closed here in California, it just in a broad sense, it doesn't look good for the Democrats in the Senate. They had a pretty, I think, 1 in 7 chance. It doesn't look like Donnelly's going to make it in Indiana. So it's down to, I mean, maybe they'll pick up, the Democrats will pick up in Nevada and in Arizona, but they can only afford to lose two. I think they've already lost two. So doesn't look promising. But what about here in California? One of the people I would most like to see booted out of office is this dreadful guy who's been one of Trump's lackeys in the worst possible way, and that's Devin Nunes up in Fresno. And that's his constituency, as far as I know, is close to 50% Latino. So what's happening with the Latino vote there? Do you think there's a chance that Nunes could lose, even though he's got a money advantage?
Well, there is a chance. I think that the Latino electorate is very, very engaged in competitive congressional districts. And it's also very engaged in communities and congressional districts, as well as other districts where the candidate who's running, incumbent or otherwise, is attacking the Latino community. And so I think that there's a chance. The other thing that we have to remember is that the Fresno area, that area has basically been neglected by California folks who turn out voters. I'm talking about the environment establishment, the labor community, it's not an area that people spend money in turning out the Latino electorate. And so when you don't spend money, you can't expect turnout to be at the same levels as other groups. But I think that in this case, because of who he is, there's a shot that Latinos and others in those communities will flip that district. It's one of the ones that's obviously being looked at and watched. And so we'll see, as is the case of the district, Congressional District 10, 25, 39, 45, and 48. So we'll see.
Well, I recently did an interview with Rui Teixeira, who wrote a piece about the Latino vote, and he said that 55% of eligible Latino voters had not been contacted by anyone, whether they're Democrat or Republican. So it doesn't look like the Democratic Party has much of a Latino outreach program.
I'm not going to disagree with the Attorney General. I think he's absolutely right. That's always been the criticism that we have is Latinos who are engaged in this business. And that is that you can't expect Latinos to turn out at the same level as other groups if there's no investment. And when you look across the board, the Democrats at the national level and at the local level have spent a lot of time investing and trying to turn out what they call the swing vote, which is the white vote. And in some cases, I don't know if that's the case in California, because California is the white voters that are conservative are more progressive than some other states. But that's certainly a problem in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, where in Texas, where they're never going to move to the left. They're not going to vote for the Democrat. And so that is a problem. But I have to tell you that in spite of that, we're going to see record numbers turn out in California. We expect that more than 2.6 million Latinos will turn out to vote in California. We expect that 1.3 million Latinos will vote in Texas. And we're going to see a record number. We projected that 9 million of the registered Latino voters are going to turn out to vote in the United States, with various, obviously, breakdown in Nevada and Arizona, where it makes a difference, as well as in Florida. However, we still don't know what will be the Trump factor. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, no, Tang, we've run out of time, I'm afraid, Lydia. I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Lydia Camarillo, who serves as the Vice President of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan organization based out of San Antonio, Texas. She was previously appointed by President Clinton and Vice President Gore to serve as the CEO of the 2000 Democratic National Convention. And she was previously the National Director of the Leadership Development Program for the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.